This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Dreaming of baguettes. That's how Yuk Chang survived for years in a Cambodian prison.
I dare to think food, you know? I think that that's something that the Khmer Rouge cannot destroy, cannot take away from me, is my soul.
This Passover week, a modern-day exodus, the secret journey of Ethiopian Jews. And calling all mystery fans, Botswana's favorite sleuth is on TV. HBO's new series stars the number one lady detective.
I love my country, Botswana, and I love Africa, and I want to do good with the time God has given me. I'm going to open a detective agency.
The bad men better watch out.
Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Peggy Waymire. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. More than three decades ago, the Khmer Rouge wiped out nearly a quarter of Cambodia's population. Now, a handful of the regime's leaders are finally facing justice at an international war crimes tribunal. The first defendant is best known by his revolutionary name, Doik. He admits to running the S-21 prison. That's where 17,000 people were tortured and executed. Doik was arrested almost 10 years ago. It's taken that long for Cambodian and UN officials to bring him to trial. Reporter Jared Ferry met with two survivors of the Khmer Rouge regime. One of them survived the infamous S-21 prison.
On a busy street in Phnom Penh, a Buddhist ceremony is taking place against the backdrop of a steady stream of traffic. I step off the street into a gallery owned by Van Nath, a local artist. A photo hanging at the entrance hints at the theme of his paintings. It's his mugshot, taken the day he entered the S-21 prison. At the time of his arrest, he was a commercial painter in the city of Battambang. He was taken to Phnom Penh and locked up in S-21, the most notorious torture center in the country. In his gallery today, overhead lights focus on Van Nath's paintings. All of them depict scenes of life and death at S-21. In the next picture, we can see a group of prisoners that are being led into S-21. They have bare feet and they're blindfolded, and it looks like they're tied together, and they're also tied by the neck, and there's a Khmer Rouge soldier that's leading them by the neck.
Back then, our feeling, we don't know what is going to happen because we don't see anything around until we get inside the prison. They take off the blindfolding, and then we can see that we are in a prison. I never have any hope that I will be survived from there.
To this day, Van Nath still doesn't know the reason for his arrest. He was interrogated when he arrived at S-21, but he was never told why.
And then they take me for questioning me, asking questions. And after all those questionnaire, they take me back to the cell and handcuffs like the painting you have seen here.
In fact, Van Nath's art saved his life. When he told the guards he was an artist, they put him to work painting portraits and sculpting busts of the Khmer Rouge leader, Pol Pot.
That's the only reason they keep me alive and to work for them, because I can do the painting. I try to make that picture look nice.
After Vietnamese troops toppled the Khmer Rouge regime in 1979, S-21 was turned into a museum. Tourists walk somberly through former torture chambers.
And look, the prisoners upside down. That would hurt so much. Can you even imagine?
In these barren rooms, there are metal cots, along with iron shackles. Horrific, blown-up pictures hang on the wall. They show the bodies of prisoners killed by the guards before they fled Vietnamese soldiers. There are also signs and illustrations explaining the methods of torture. The displays were set up by the Documentation Center of Cambodia, an organization dedicated to uncovering Khmer Rouge atrocities. When prosecutors make their cases against former Khmer Rouge leaders, they will use many of those documents as evidence. Yuk Chang heads the center. He was not held at S-21, but he spent 4 years at a work camp where he almost died of starvation. He was only 13 when he was taken there. He credits his survival to dreams of baguettes.
So every night I would think of baguette, my favorite. I eat it since I was a little child. And I do that every night. It worked, trust me. It worked because you feel like so powerful, because thinking like this is capitalist or bourgeois and against the Khmer Rouge Revolution. I dare to think food, you know? I think that that's something that the Khmer Rouge cannot destroy, cannot take away from me, is my soul.
Yuk Chang says he's trying to help all Cambodians understand what happened under the Khmer Rouge so that it never happens again. But it's also part of his personal healing process.
I was there, I was a victim, I was starved, I was beaten, I was put in prisons. But those things now, I'm making up by working on this, collecting this, sharing this, educating to the younger, and then I move on. I think that's what I'm doing, I guess. You know.
And that's the hope for the War Crimes Tribunal, too, that it'll help Cambodians move on from a nightmare that has stalked them for 30 years. As for the tribunal's first defendant, Doik says he's sorry for the crimes he committed as head of the S21 prison. His victim, the artist Van Nath, says he's reserving judgment about whether the remorse is sincere.
I cannot say anything, and I just have to wait until the court make the last verdicts, and then I have to decide if he's a good man again or bad man.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Jared Ferry in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
There's a slideshow and a blog to go along with this story. They're on our website, worldvisionreport.org. President Obama has announced plans to withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq, but thousands of young Ugandans are lining up to go to the war-torn country. The Ugandans are recruited by private American corporations. The companies have contracts with the U.S. government to supply security. Freelance reporter Max Delaney lives in Kampala, Uganda. He covered this story for the Christian Science Monitor. Max joins us by phone. Why is it that American security companies are hiring so many Ugandans?
Because as a former British colony, Ugandans are English-speaking, so it's easier for them to communicate with the Americans out in Iraq. And because Uganda had a very brutal insurgency in the north of the country, there's a lot of well-trained and unemployed army veterans who are knocking around the countries who can be employed as guards in Iraq.
So how many Ugandans are we talking about that are going over to Iraq right now?
At the moment, there's around 10,000, more than 10,000 Ugandans. And if you take into account that they can serve a maximum 2 years, that means that since 2005, tens of thousands of Ugandans cumulatively have actually served there, and maybe as many as 100,000. So it's an awful high number.
There must be a big upside for the Ugandans that makes it worth it to take this risk. Is it just about the money?
Pretty much, it's just about the money. Since 2005, the wage has gone down to about $600 a month. Now, that's pretty much pittance compared to the amount that a US guard or a guard from Britain or Europe would make if he was doing the same job. But to a Ugandan, that's probably, if a young man of 26, 27 was lucky enough to have a job here in Uganda, he'd be making maybe a tenth of what he could earn as a guard in Iraq.
So it's not a pittance for a Ugandan. When they come home, they might be considered wealthy by their neighbors.
Yeah. I mean, this one young man of 26 I spoke to while he was back in Uganda, after having worked for a year in Iraq, he'd managed to build two houses in his village. He'd bought himself a banana plantation and doubled the size of the cattle herd that his father had left him. So although he complained to me a lot that the companies higher up are making billions of dollars and it's not fair that he's making hundreds of dollars and taking all the risk. It still seemed like he'd done very well out of going to Iraq.
Are men and women lining up for these jobs?
Yeah. If you go around the offices of the companies here in Uganda who are hiring, you'll find queues of people around Kampala who are desperate to go out. In some places, you'll find whole communities, whole families, extended families who club together to put a favored son or a favored daughter through the training course. Because if they don't live in Kampala, they have to come to Kampala, so they have to pay for accommodation here. Then they have to, there's a lot of medical tests, they have to get themselves a passport. The costs mount up, so in the end, it means that they've made a pretty considerable investment in the hope that one day they'll have someone in Iraq sending back a lot of money.
There's obviously some risk involved. Have you determined how many Ugandans have been killed working in Iraq or wounded?
Only a handful of Ugandans have been wounded or lost their lives out in Iraq. I mean, it is a spectacularly risky job that they're doing. They're guarding the US bases, airports, oil firms, so the key targets around Iraq. But in that respect, there's been relatively low casualties.
You've got tens of thousands of Ugandans going to Iraq. How is this affecting the Ugandan economy?
Well, according to the minister in charge, or the former minister in charge of this issue, the Ugandan guards in Iraq send back $90 million a year, which is compared to the $60 or $70 million that Uganda makes from its main export, which is coffee. So it's had a huge impact on the Ugandan economy.
And nevertheless, I understand there's some controversy inside the country about this, and some critics are equating what's going on with human trafficking.
There is an opinion that the Ugandans are being used as cheap labor to fight someone else's war. I mean, they're not actually doing the fighting, they're static guards, but there is that opinion. But then, comparatively, they're earning so much more money than they would earn if they could find a job here, that it's a long stretch to equate it to human trafficking or to the slave trade, as some of the wilder accusations in the press here have been.
So we've got tens of thousands of Ugandans going to Iraq. What about Afghanistan? Are we going to see American companies hiring Ugandans for other wars?
Yeah, I mean, now that Obama has announced a relatively quick withdrawal from Iraq and shifted the focus to Afghanistan, so the Ugandan companies have started shifting their focus to Afghanistan, too. And it was just announced that within a month, there should be the first batch of 300 Ugandans going out to Afghanistan to work, doing the same jobs they're doing in Iraq and for pretty much the same pay, but on another front line of the war on terror.
Max Delaney, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
Max Delaney is a freelance reporter living in Kampala, Uganda. And coming up,
I love my country, Botswana, and I love Africa.
That's Precious Ramotswe, the number one ladies detective. We talk with the man who created her character ahead on the World Vision Report.
The bad men better watch out.
This is the World Vision Report, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Every year, students in India vie for places at the nation's leading science universities. The colleges are known collectively as the Indian Institutes of Technology. Across the country, hundreds of thousands of students take the entrance exam. Only a handful, about the top 2%, are accepted. One math teacher has had extraordinary success getting his students in, despite the fact that many of them come from extreme poverty. From the northern city of Patna, the World Vision Report's Peter Aronson has the story.
For India's best and brightest, an IIT diploma is a golden career ticket. So the competition to get in is understandably fierce. Parents often spend big bucks on special tutoring programs to prepare their kids for the entrance exam. But what can students do if their parents can't afford 3 square meals a day, let alone money for tutoring? That's where mathematician Anand Kumar comes in.
Problem number 18,
Kumar teaches in an open-air classroom, complete with dirt floor and tin roof. About 100 students sit crammed tightly together on simple wooden benches. They range in age from about 18 to 20, and about a third of them are girls. They sit separately.
palace.
When Kumar writes on the blackboard, the students in back are so far away, it's almost impossible to make out what he's writing. But they don't complain, because no one in this class is paying a single rupee for the one-year course. The class started 7 years ago, and Kumar decided it was time for his successful prep course company to give something back to the community.
In 2002, I started a special group for extremely poor students who can't afford even the basic necessities of life. I selected the 30 sharpest who were poor, but who had the guts and the passion for math and science.
He called them the Super 30. He put them up in a dorm, and his own mother cooked them two simple hot meals a day, more than some of them got at home. Freed of financial concerns, the boys dedicated themselves exclusively to their studies. And when exam time finally came, the Super 30 lived up to their name.
After a year of hard work, 18 of my students qualified for Institutes of Technology, and the other 12 made it into the National Institutes of Technology. So I got a full batch of 30 students into the best engineering colleges in India.
Kumar became an overnight celebrity and a local hero. Since that first class, more and more of his students have gotten into IIT. And last year,
all 30. So that's my Super 30.
Keshav Nandan, a quiet village boy who dreams of working for NASA, is in this year's Super 30 class. He heard about it when he was in ninth grade.
What makes Super 30 special is that there's no pressure on us to get into IIT. Mr. Anand only tells us to enjoy mathematics, and often he provides 10 or 12 solutions for a single equation, and it's real fun to study that way.
Kumar teaches 70 more students tuition-free, although they don't get room and board like the Super 30. Last year, about 70% of them got into IIT. And nothing could please their teacher more, because he also grew up poor. Kumar had to turn down a scholarship to Cambridge because there was no money for travel or accommodations. Instead, he stayed home.
My mother started making flatbreads to support the family, and I was taking them around and selling them. That's how we got two square meals a day.
Meanwhile, he continued his studies at the local university, where a prominent mathematician took him on as a kind of apprentice. Over the years, Kumar has grown prosperous, and his reputation has grown as well. Local economist Shaibal Gupta explains why the people of this city love him.
He's sort of a very, very mini Warren Buffett or Bill Gates, who after accumulating their wealth, has parted with certain part of the wealth for the common people.
But not everyone loves him. A few years ago, Kumar started getting death threats from some competitors. He calls them the coaching mafias. Police traced one of the calls to a known felon and warned Kumar not to leave his home. But he didn't want to let his students down. That day, an attacker came at him with a sickle.
One of the staff members came between the sickle and me, and he was seriously wounded. He was admitted in the hospital for months, fighting for life, and after that, the police gave me security.
Now, four machine gun-toting bodyguards and a Doberman guard this mathematician and his family 24/7. Undeterred, he says he hopes to expand the size of the Super 30 group in the coming years. One competing school, though, not to be outdone on the charity front, recently announced it's going to start a scholarship group of its own. It's calling it the Fortunate 40. For the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson in Patna, India.
In Kenya, Easter is an important religious holiday. In this predominantly Christian country, Kenyans celebrate by leaving their towns and cities and returning to their home villages. That's where friends and families worship and meet for days. An integral part of their celebration is the roasting of a goat for Easter dinner. Goat could be considered Kenya's national dish, and in some places it's eaten year-round. We sent our reporter Richard Locke to a Kenyan restaurant that specializes in goat. He brings us the latest in our What's Cooking series.
The kitchen at the Olipolos Country Club on the edge of Kenya's Rift Valley is basic, very basic. Down one side, three whole skinned goats hang from large metal hooks. In the middle of this rudimentary brick shelter is a large charcoal grill covered with sizzling hunks of meat. The title Country Club is something of a misnomer. You won't find a spa or even a swimming pool here. It's really just a restaurant. In fact, Oli Polos does one thing, but it does it well, and that's nyama choma.
This nyama choma means the roasted meat. The most especially we roast the goat ribs and the arm, because they are the sweetest meat when it is roasted. Yeah.
That's Jacob Ole Ingoroya, one of the men behind the grill. The shoulder or a rack of ribs might be the best cuts, but nothing from the goat goes to waste here.
Almost we cook every part of the goat apart from the skin and the hooves. So apart from the arm and the ribs, which is best for roasting, we also have the leg, which is best for boiling, for soup, and also the leg is better when fried.
And there's one final surprise.
We also have the intestines, where we make the African sausage using the intestines. It's famous called motura.
How do you serve the intestine?
You clean the large intestine. The small intestine, when you have cut them, you put them in the large intestine, and then you boil it for some minutes. And then again, you put it on a hot chiko for drying, and then that's now the mtura.
The result is something which looks like a large bloated sausage. Oli Polos is only about 30 miles from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, but this is well and truly Maasai land. Outside the kitchen, the deep tears in the earth's crust that form the Rift Valley stretch away to the horizon. For Nairobi's middle class who frequents this eatery, a meal here is about devouring chunks of tender goat meat. But for Jacob Ole Ingoroya and his Maasai tribe, the goat has traditionally been second in importance only to the cow.
The goat is a very important animal to the Maasai because it provides so many things to the Maasai. For example, when somebody has a lot of goat, it acts as prestige to the person. Also, it's a source of income sometimes. And also, it provides some important gadgets. For example, clothing in ceremonies is provided by the goat.
A few feet away from the grill is a second open-air cooking area where side dishes are made.
Whatever is being prepared here is the what we call the kachumbari. It's an accompaniment for the nyama choma.
And what is kachumbari?
Kachumbari is the mixture of tomatoes, onions, and other greens like hot pepper.
And of course, the real nyama choma experience is incomplete without washing it down with copious quantities of warm Tusker beer. For the World Vision Report, I'm Richard Locke in Oli Polos, Kenya.
I love my country, Botswana, and I love Africa, and I want to do good with the time God has given me. I'm going to open a detective agency.
And she did. That's Precious Ramotswe, owner of the number one ladies detective agency. The TV series is currently running on HBO. It's been adapted from the best-selling books by Alexander McCall Smith. He set the stories in Botswana in southern Africa.
I had the great good fortune of spending my childhood not far from Botswana in Zimbabwe, and so I obviously had a feeling for the place. And many years ago, I went and lived in Botswana for a while, just under a year. I was working at the University of Botswana then, and I found that I was very intrigued by this country. It's a remarkable country in many respects. And I didn't think at the time that I would necessarily write about it, but as life happened, I eventually sat down and started to write what was then a very short story about a woman who lived in Botswana, who sells the cattle left her by her father and starts a detective agency. And I don't know why I chose for her to start a detective agency. She could have started something more practical, a garage perhaps, or a bakery or something of that sort.
We should tell listeners that this isn't really a series of serious detective adventures, even though it's called the number one ladies detective agency. In fact, Precious Ramotswe's adventures are so simple, people are calling on her to solve the most normal day-to-day problems.
Yes, they do. She's approached, as you say, about very small problems. not great crimes. There's no real crime in these books. These really aren't mysteries. These really aren't detective stories, because there's nothing of that nature which happens. So it tends to be very, very minor things. Occasionally she comes up against somebody who's crooked in one way or another, but generally speaking, it's minor matters. Women are concerned about their behavior of their husbands, for example. That crops up from time to time. Maybe there's a slightly dishonest employee or something of that sort. And Mara Motsui's philosophy of detection is that the answer is often there staring you in the face, or people know the answer to the question that they're actually asking you. And she takes the view that if you want to find something out, just ask people.
Yeah, I want to talk about the main character, Precious Ramotswain. She is a very interesting character. She's very strong, very wise, but not at all arrogant. And she lives a very simple life. If you were, and you're smiling there, the listeners can't see, but why are you smiling? How do you feel about Precious?
Well, the reason why I was smiling was that I think you were describing her very well. And I think that you'd got across the essence of the woman in that. She's a traditionally built lady, as she calls herself, which means she's actually really pretty big. And she takes the view that this is how ladies in that part of Africa traditionally were, and it was thought to be very nice to be a very comfortable shape. And she disagrees very strongly with the modern emphasis on ladies being really rather thin, in her view. She's a very clever woman. She's intuitive. And she is also a very kind person. She's a person who fully understands what the problems of the world are. And, of course, she sees deprivation and suffering daily. But she would say that you've got to lead your life in a way which enables you to hope for something better and to work towards something better. I think there are a lot of people who lead lives like Mara Motsui's in Africa, for example. If one visits sub-Saharan African countries, often you see amidst the many problems which are undoubtedly there, you see people leading lives of great integrity and leading these lives with dignity and with good spirit, often in pretty appalling circumstances. And that, I think, is a matter of remark.
On our show, we do a lot of stories about Africa, but usually it's about the incredible suffering, poverty, HIV, AIDS. You show a very different side of Africa.
Well, I think that I probably do show a different side, because I think that there's been an understandable concentration on what one might describe as the social pathology of contemporary Africa. If you read much about contemporary Africa, you would end up reading about the failure of the modern state in many circumstances, about corruption, about economic difficulties, about natural disaster, about civil war, genocide, and so on, all of which is there and is part of the picture. But all that I would say is that isn't the entire picture. And the other side of the picture is a picture of people with these tremendous human qualities leading their decent lives in the middle of all that and leading those lives well.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Alexander McCall Smith is the author of the number one ladies detective agency. The TV adaptation of his book series is currently airing on HBO. As Alexander McCall Smith said, it's usually the bad or the sad stuff we hear about when it comes to the developing world. But reporter Conrad Fox discovered bad and sad may all be in the eye of the beholder. Conrad was in Colombia not too long ago, reporting on the conflict there between the government, paramilitaries, and left-wing guerrillas. But in the midst of all the suffering, Conrad found what's missing in most war reporting. Here's his reporter's notebook.
I've just interviewed this group of refugees in Bogota. They were attending a workshop given by an aid agency. These people have just told me about fleeing their homes, losing their livelihoods, and in some cases losing family members, all because of the conflict between rebels and paramilitaries. The interviews have left them and me feeling choked up. And it's the tragedy that you, the listener, would hear about in my story. But that may give the impression that these victims live in a permanent state of sorrow, unable to return to anything resembling a normal life. And nothing could be further from the truth. What you won't hear in my report is the moment when the instructor hands out information on how to survive in the city. It comes in folders like the ones school children use. They are probably donated by a local business. One of the men gets a folder with Barbie on the cover. He turns bright red, and the others tease him mercilessly. Laughter is the only thing that helps us survive, says one woman. Then she adds, laughing even harder, if people could see us now, they'd never believe we were refugees. I do get to see them, and many other victims wiping away their tears and getting on with their lives, even if I don't get to report on those details all the time. But I have to admit that sometimes I'm so intent on searching out tragedy that I miss those moments myself. At a soup kitchen in one of Cali's most run-down, dangerous neighborhoods, a church pastor tells me how he never knows from one week to the next if he'll have funding to keep the kitchen open. Last month, it was closed for 2 weeks. God knows what the people do then, he says grimly. He tells me about gang violence, dissolution of families, drug abuse. Everything here is broken down, the streets are dusty, an open sewage canal runs nearby. How can anyone smile in a place like this, I think, and I feel a shudder of despair. Back home, I scour the recording for the sound bits that will best express that despair. But as I listen closely to the tape, I hear something else. There's a piano somewhere in the building. I can't make out what's being played. Perhaps it's a choir practice or a piano lesson. But the soft, gentle notes remind me of this piece. I don't always get to do this, but for once, I'd like to pay tribute to the person, whoever it is, who is making these happy sounds, instead of telling tragic tales to a reporter.
That was World Vision Report correspondent Conrad Fox. Coming up, the resilience of Rwandans after a genocide. Stay with us. You're back with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. This month marks the 15th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. Nearly 1 million people died. The children who were orphaned by the killings are now young adults, and they found a way to overcome the loss of their families. Anna Boyka Wyrock reports from the capital, Kigali.
It's a pretty normal day at the Kigali Institute of Education. A group of students is hanging out at the outdoor cafe. They chat and drink soda like college kids anywhere. But these students, all orphans, are members of an unusual support group. It's called the Association of Student Genocide Survivors. The group goes by its French initials, ADG. The ADG grew from just a few members 12 years ago to around 3,000 members across Rwanda today. Each chapter of the ADG makes up so-called families of 10 people. They elect two of those students to play the role of mom and dad. 24-year-old Oswald Muizergwa is the father of this group.
What I do is to always approach the children. Some of them are older than me, but I have to assume responsibility to know what is the problem. They need counseling.
If they do need counseling, Oswald sets it up with a student who is trained by a local nonprofit. Many students in the ADG were traumatized by what they saw during the genocide. Sometimes, the trauma gets in the way of studying and trying to live a normal life. Felicite Mukeshimana is a child in a different student family. Survivors like her often grapple with depression.
Sometimes we meet many problems. So members come and visit me. They try to convince me if I have, for example, bad ideas. So it's a good therapist, and I wish to live with them always.
Felicite is studying English history. Like many orphans in Rwanda, she doesn't have much money, so her student family helps her get what she needs.
I live with two sisters. I call them my sisters. Because when I lose, for example, man for buy a soap, they buy it for me. If I am sick, they bring me at the hospital.
Felicite lost her parents, aunts, uncles, and four siblings in the genocide. She says the ADG has helped her cope with the past.
After the genocide, I didn't think that I would be with others. I don't know that I will have others who can give me the affection. Now, I have a family, I have friends.
After the students graduate, they join an alumni network and keep in touch with their old student families. They can even join new families off campus. Still, some say these make-believe families can only go so far. Dr. Yvonne Kayeteshonga is a leading psychologist in Rwanda.
Ils s'organisent comme ils peuvent. Mais ça n'exclut pas des problèmes psychologiques.
She says the ADG students organize themselves as best they can, but that doesn't get rid of their psychological problems. They're not real parents. She says they need adults to take care of them. According to Dr. Kayeteshonga, many of these students dread vacations because they don't have anyone to talk to away from school. She and other health professionals are trying to form an adult support network for students when classes are on break. Dr. Kayeteshonga says adults were the ones who betrayed the youth and killed their families. The youth are victims. So adults must be the ones to help the youth deal with their everyday problems. Back on campus, the ADG members head to the dorms to study. They lock arms and make jokes. As they laugh together, it's hard to imagine what they've come through. Group father Oswald Muizergwa just graduated, but he stays involved with the ADG. He says helping his peers makes him want to succeed too.
If they call you a father, you are something else, you are someone else, you have a responsibility, you have to change behavior in order to be an example for them. Yeah, it's very important to guide you in your life.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Anna Boyko-Warak in Kigali, Rwanda.
And we're going to stay in Rwanda for a moment to tell you how a mountain bike pioneer is helping coffee farmers there. Here's this week's Globe at a Glance. Are you ready for a ride to Rwanda? That's the question mountain biker Tom Ritchie asked his cycling buddies in Cape Town, South Africa. The team set off last year on the 2,000-mile road trip north. It's all part of a plan called Project Rwanda, which provides coffee farmers with bicycles to transport their coffee beans. Ritchie began the project in 2005 when a friend invited him to tour Rwanda by bicycle. It was 11 years after the genocide, and Ritchie was so moved by the efforts of Rwandans to heal and reconcile that he decided to devote his life to helping them. Ritchie was a cyclist and bicycle designer. He noticed that Rwandan coffee farmers desperately needed help getting their beans to the market. So Ritchie designed a special bike, one with enough space to stack sacks of coffee beans. Coffee farmers in Rwanda can now deliver their beans faster and get paid a higher price for a fresher product. And that's good news for farmers who produce Rwanda's number one export. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer, and you're listening to the World Vision Report. Last Sunday, the New York Times ran a front-page story about the abduction of little boys in rural China. It's a big problem in a country where the one-child policy has led to widespread kidnapping of male children. The story was originally broken a few years ago by British journalist Michael Sheridan. We spoke with him shortly after his reporting assignment. Unfortunately, the problem in China hasn't gotten any better. Here again is our interview with Michael Sheridan.
In this one city we went to, Kunming, where there are several million people, over 200 boys have been kidnapped in the last 3 to 4 years, and the kidnappings continue to occur. If this was in New York City or London, proportionately adjusted, there would be 400 or 500 children missing. You can imagine the outrage that would result.
Yes, I'm even surprised we haven't been hearing more about it daily in our news over here.
The Chinese government has taken a decision to suppress any further news about this because, essentially, they don't like bad news. The media did originally report some of the kidnappings because there was popular outrage, But since it became a matter of protest and complaint to the central government, Chinese journalists have been ordered to keep quiet about it, and the police, bizarrely, have been harassing the parents, not searching for the kidnappers.
Michael, who is kidnapping the children and why? Have you been able to uncover that at all?
The best guess from the Chinese police, backed up by some UN inquiries, points to loosely knit gangs. Sometimes an entire family will be involved in this kind of gang activity. Sometimes an entire village is participating. And there are networks to pass children on from these poor, remote districts of southwest China to richer cities on the Chinese coast, where couples are willing to pay substantial sums of money, $5,000 or more, to have a child.
You did go to some of these villages and you met with some of the parents who have lost their children. Is there any kind of pattern to how these children and toddlers are being snatched?
Each story is different, but there are certain things in common. And one thing that will resonate with every parent is that almost every kidnapping occurred when the parent's back was turned. I met one father who told me how he went to set up his market stall one morning in a busy fruit and vegetable market, and he had his two young sons with him, aged 4 and 6, and he went to get the stall from the storage area where it's kept overnight, which took no more than a minute or two, and he came back and his two boys were gone. They had simply vanished. I met one couple who came to us and gave us photographs of their children. The child that was missing had been outside in the street. His father went down the street to buy him some sweets from a stall. When he came back, the boy was gone.
Michael, since the 1970s, China has had a national one-child policy. Do these kidnappings have anything to do with that?
The one-child policy is really at the root of the kidnapping industry in China because it maximizes the value of a healthy male child. If you are a Chinese person living in a city, you may not have more than one child. If you do have more than one child, you can be severely penalized financially, professionally. You could lose your accommodation. There are lots of administrative and, in some cases, coercive measures that can be taken against you. If, on the other hand, you acquire a child by adoption or by telling neighbors that this is a cousin or a niece, no birth control regulation has been broken, no illegitimate birth has taken place so far as the state is concerned, and therefore it creates a desirable market in these children.
Michael, it seems like this story that I read of yours was very emotionally charged.
Well, as you may know, Chinese people, their culture and their social training predisposes them to keep emotions in check. They don't believe in letting it all hang out. We were actually approached by this desperate group of parents who had been to the Chinese government, who had been to the local authorities, who had pleaded with the police. They sought publicity in the international media because that was the last thing they could do. And meeting them, which we did in a clandestine fashion, meeting them was a very wrenching experience because they themselves were overcome with rage and grief and guilt, of course, because they feel guilty about the fact that they let their children be snatched in this way. And there's a terrible feeling also, which is the knowledge that their child is alive, the almost certain sense that the child is growing up somewhere else in China, in another family, and not really knowing who his real parents are.
What was this reporting assignment like for you?
Well, I've covered China for 10 years, and I've covered wars and revolutions and coups for 25 years. I think what made an impression on me about this case was the way that these Chinese people really felt not only beaten and battered by their system, but abandoned by their government and let down by the supposedly strong social networks that bind Asian societies together. And what was particularly moving was the fact that the very courageous lawyer who had put together a petition by hundreds of these families, and I mean hundreds, this isn't a couple of dozen people, had got together individual pictures of each of these children. Every family had provided a mugshot or a happy snap of the child, maybe playing with a toy or out on its holidays or in the park with mummy and daddy. It was very, very wrenching to see these images of very happy, cheerful, playful children in a loving family environment. And we printed in the newspaper, the Sunday Times, all the pictures we could get, several hundred, which made a great impression on readers because suddenly there were faces to these missing boys. And we call them the Lost Boys of China because they are lost, literally. They're lost to their parents. They're out there somewhere. Who knows what will become of them?
Is there any hope on the horizon for these families? Is anybody in the international community doing anything?
I think there is some hope for these families. They have made a lot of public protest. Even though the Chinese media now obediently ignores them, the police, I think, do not actually want this to continue. This is very embarrassing. The Chinese government likes to present itself as presiding over a peacefully evolving society where American multinationals can come and invest. And so there is a renewed police effort to do something about it. I suppose the only thing that might be consoling, and I think some of the parents, although very bitter, do feel consoled by this, is at least the knowledge that these children have not, by and large, been kidnapped for the purposes of abuse or exploitation. They have been kidnapped because families desire boys and they wish to bring those boys up as their sons. One of the very saddest remarks that a mother made to us was that she knew that her family was poor, and she at least felt that her son, her lost son, might grow up in a household where there was more money and more opportunity, and perhaps he would have a better life. But that's a pretty dreadful conclusion for a mother to have to reach.
Yes, it certainly is. Michael Sheridan, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
That was British journalist Michael Sheridan. Passover is celebrated by Jews around the world this week. The holiday recounts the biblical story of the Exodus from Egypt to the Promised Land. There's one community that especially identifies with the Exodus story, the Ethiopian Jews. Moshe Sheta is one of them. 25 years ago, when he was 5, he and his family left their village in Ethiopia for Israel. They were fleeing famine, civil war, and religious persecution. To help them, Israeli officials began smuggling Jews out of Ethiopia. Moshe's father helped organize a mass airlift in 1991. It set a world record for the largest number of passengers on a single flight, 1,122 passengers. Moshe was one of them.
My story is complicated. We always dreamed from ancient days to come to Jerusalem and to connect with our brothers in Zion. My father one day woke me up and said, "Let's go, we're going. Where are we going? We're going to Jerusalem." The whole thing was a secret operation. We only told one person, my dad's best friend. We took 3 donkeys and put our stuff on them. We left in the middle of the night not to wake anybody up. We just started walking towards the unknown. During the day, we would sleep, rest, eat. In the night, we would walk so no one would catch us. My little brother died on the way from the village to Sudan. He couldn't survive the cold weather at night and the hot weather during the day. I carried him in my hands. To see him suddenly stop breathing, it stays with you all your life. I was angry at my parents. We just put him in the ground, buried him under the dirt. No crying, nothing. On the third day, we got up and walked. Suddenly, we heard a scream, "Stop or we will shoot you." My dad tried to negotiate with the thieves, but they put a gun to his head and said, "You have a decision to make. Either you see the death of your children, or you go back to where you came from." We went back to the village. It turned out that same friend of Dad's told on us. When we got back to the village, my little sister died of a disease she got during the journey. 2 weeks we stayed in the village. Then we said we were going to the city to a hotel for a little vacation. In Addis Ababa, we rented an apartment for 1 year. In the morning, my dad would go to the Israeli embassy and would come home in the afternoon and tell mom. He'd whisper, "We children had no idea." For 12 months, until one morning, like back in the village, he woke us all up and said, "Come." It was the first time I flew on an airplane. Then suddenly, someone said in Amharic, "We have arrived in Jerusalem." Everyone said, "It must be a dream." When we got off the plane, we kissed the ground. Passover, for me, isn't just about the exodus of the people of Israel from Egypt. I have my own personal freedom. I and my community. It's a miracle.
That's Moshe Shetta. And the chanting you're hearing is sung on Passover by Ethiopian Jews during their traditional pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And that brings us to the end of our show today. Remember, you can download a podcast of this show at our website, worldvisionreport.org. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for joining us.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.